So we begin as we normally do. We'll take refuge together. We'll generate the mind of enlightenment. We'll say the other prayers. Then engage with the teaching itself. And during the teaching, there are moments where we can pause and ask questions or meditate. Now, first of all, what you need to do is just get really comfortable in your seat. I just checked your spine is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, and your hands and feet are placed in comfortable positions. Then allow your eyes to close completely or to remain partially open. Now let your body breathe itself. While the body breathes itself, imagine the space before you appears Shakyamuni Buddha sitting on a golden throne. He's surrounded by many other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And you are surrounded by all sentient beings. Everyone is facing the Buddha and the spiritual entourage. And in doing so, we recollect how fortunate we are to still be alive today, to have met a spiritual teacher, and to be engaged with practicing the Dharma. So the Dharma that we're practicing is a Mahayana Dharma, which means that its basis is deep and great compassion. We think that by engaging in the practices, you will rely upon the Buddha, who is the teacher. His teaching is called the Dharma, and his spiritual community called the Sangha. And by relying on them, we can put an end to the causes of our suffering and therefore bring the effect of suffering to an end. And we're doing this not just for ourselves, but it's for all living beings. So just affirm that you wish to become enlightened to benefit all sentient beings. And to accomplish that benefit, you're going to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and his spiritual community. So join me in saying, I go for refuge and self-enlightenment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge and self-enlightenment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge and self-enlightenment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So now I imagine that in response to this prayer of ours, lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. These lights and nectars wash over you and over everybody surrounding you. And obstacles and hindrances to your spiritual path are removed. And your potentials of method and wisdom that exist naturally are empowered. You're able to recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and decide to establish these states within yourself and all living beings. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering in its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred or enemies. Again, lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. These wash over you and all the sentient beings surrounding you. And your faith and devotion to the objects of refuge increase. For being in front of the field of merit, you join me in saying, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present tithes of every type of offering, absolute measures. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all whole and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle of existence and turn the wind of Dharma to living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. That will prevent us clinging to the practice of purification and the accumulation of merit. Recollect emptiness, that all phenomena are without an independent existence, and everything exists dependently. And the most subtle level of dependency is that of labeling and consciousness. But from that basis, think that your body now takes on the aspect of a pure land. And your merit and all objects of your normal senses are utterly transformed. So that this ground is anointed with perfume, the storm of flowers, the dawn of Mount Mary, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is the work of your body. May all of the beings and works be there. So the Buddha accepts the offer, and he smiles at us, and we meet the gaze of the Buddha. And looking up into his eyes, we feel accepted and at ease and confident that the spiritual work we're doing will bear fruit. Now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to the Bible of the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation now descends to the level of your heart. The Bible begins to expand, filling the body and mind with light. And the light pours out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space, and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And resonating throughout the vast expanse of enlightenment, you hear the sound of the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha. And you join in reciting it with me. And then start a few times under your breath. And the rays of light withdraw from the 10 directions of space and then re-enter your heart. You can hear the sounds of traffic passing by, you can feel the sleep beneath you. You know that you're embodied. And you are confirmed that this meditation has been one of imagination, which has imprinted the mind, providing conditions for your full awakening. Just rejoice in that, and then breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through the mouth. In your own time, let your eyes flutter away. Again, welcome everybody, and let's just briefly go through what we've covered. So we've looked at the need for a spiritual teacher. What's the need expressed as a reason? In other words, we need to rely upon a spiritual teacher because we do... Okay. Thank you, Chris. Now we need to look for qualified teachers. So we know that these teachers are meant to have like 10 qualities. Ideally, they would have 10 qualities. Give us the first three. Ian, if you would like.
They follow the three hard training.
That's right. The three hard training. So
deep serenity.
Thoroughly pacified. Yeah. They're disciplined, serene, and thoroughly pacified. That's right. And in relationship to... ourselves, they have more knowledge than ourselves. What else do they need to have?
Scriptural knowledge.
Scriptural knowledge and...
understanding of nature of reality.
That's right, understanding the nature of reality. That's right. And finally, there are four qualities to have a good relationship with the student. What are those four qualities?
Loving kindness.
You're reading off your notes and still got a point. It goes sail. You go sail. Skillful. Have abandoned the spirit. Have love and compassion and enthusiasm. Thank you. And the roles of teachers change over time, so sometimes we need teachers who are more like scholastic teachers or professors. As we progress through, we'll need to find a Mahayana teacher, then a Tantra teacher, and so forth. So teachers take different roles and sometimes require different teachers for those roles. The students qualified by those five qualities. Jordan, do you tell us what they are?
Non-biased. Intelligent, greatly diligent, attentive, receptive.
Excellent. That's right. Here's our fire call as well. And so, all in all, we're trying to develop faith and and a devotion to the teacher. He sees the teacher themselves as a Buddha, and there are sort of four reasons to say why the teacher is a Buddha. Can anybody just give me one?
Well, Bajidara
says so. That one. Thank you. Okay, so next week we want a different reason. You've already got one, you must get another one. Of course, I've been relying on a lot of material, but the foundation of Buddhist practice has a lot of material on this topic. It's expressed very simply, and there's a commentary on it and steps on the path to enlightenment. And we have down here the heart of the path. All of this material is in that book. It's well put across. Still a couple of copies up there that are quite cheap to buy if you wish to. And, of course, it's relating to spiritual teachers. Not so easy to get, but sometimes I've ended up there on sale. So if you do see one, I'd suggest you snap it up. And, of course, there's a book by Alexander Berzin. And if you go to a site called Study Buddhism, all this material that's in that book is up there anyway. So. I can access it that way. So today we're looking at this topic called devotion in action, and it's got three parts: relationship difficulties and responses. So the three questions are: what can you do when you encounter problems in the spiritual relationship? What are some of the techniques that can be applied to restore the relationship? And what can you do if the relationship no longer works? So these three questions come from the suggested public exam. And there's a question from the assessment questions that asks, how would you work with a crisis in your relationship with a teacher? And since we'll have a look at these sort of things this evening. And again, like I said, there's really good material on this in Alexander Berzin's book and on his site. So in terms of relating to the guru or spiritual teacher with actions, there are three parts to this topic. And they are making material offerings, are offering respect and service and then carrying out the advice. So of the three ways of responding to your guru through your actions, the most important here is which one do you think? Number three, carrying out the advice.
That's right.
In fact, Milarepa, if you know about him, he had very little to offer his guru. Like he was living in the cave and all he had to eat himself was thistles. And at that time, I think most of the time he was naked in that cave until his sister, out of embarrassment, got him a cotton cloth. Must be called, that's how he got his name. The cotton clad one. Milarepa. So he had his skin had turned green, so he couldn't offer his teacher any material offerings. Of course, he had a great deal of respect for his teacher, and the service he was carrying out was carrying out the advice of his teacher. So we'll go through each of these, and then we'll come across to the part where we talk about more about the problems that arise. So in terms of making material offerings, whatever you make, it should be what you yourself find really pleasing. That's it in a nutshell. So there are basically about three parts of this. So you try to offer the best that you genuinely can. In 50 verses of Guru Devotion, it says, give what is rare and special or a little better than average. In other words, don't keep the finest for yourself. But if it's a very simple gift, is all you have, and it pleases the guru, there's no fault. So you find many people just offer the carter. The second thing you want to do is you offer it with the mind of guru yoga, meaning that each time you give, with any sort of gift, remember that the guru is one with all the Buddhas. So you try to remember that it's not just the human teacher I'm giving it to. I'm offering it to Dharmakaya, Samanakaya, Nirmanakaya, all the Buddhas, all the Buddha's body, speech, and mind are all contained in this one appearance of my teacher. And when you make the offerings, you're not making it because the guru needs the things you're giving. I mean, if they do and you work this on, they're like, well, that's great too. But you're primarily offering to create more merit for yourself. There are more stronger bond between you and your teacher, an energetic bond. And so this, of course, is the easiest thing you can do, usually. But, you know, if you ever try to offer something material to a teacher, you'll find that it's not that easy, is it? So they require so little. Now, we've got their robes, and not much else you can sort of think of. So do that. Of course, one of the simplest things you can always offer, of course, especially visiting teachers are here, or your own teacher, there's nothing, no harm in offering money, just put it in an envelope and offer it respectfully. The result, they can find plenty to do with money. Now, the other thing you can make offerings of these material things is things for the Sangha. So most times when we're a teacher, they won't be lay people, they're ordained. So this is what the ordained need, new robes. They always need food, and there's lodging and medicine. So the Western Buddhist Sangha sort of face unique challenges in maintaining a monastic life. So if you know some of the Sangha here, it's many of them still have to make a living. It's not ideal, so they have to either work in their robes, or sometimes the workplace doesn't want them in their robes, so they have to sort of work without robes, and they finish work, they put their robes back on, then they go home and do their practices and so forth. Other than that, this is pretty straightforward, isn't it? I remember, in fact, many years ago, when Chodron Rinpoche came, his attendant suggested that we put up the money for a hotel so they could all live in. And you know, we looked at that and thought, this is going to be quite an expensive undertaking. And we discovered that one of our students, her and her husband, had a two-story house and nothing happened in the second story. And at the time, this woman, she hadn't taken refuge and she'd never had a tantric initiation. Anyway, Tony Rinpoche went to stay at her place. The first talk he gave, she took refuge. And the very next day, she did her first medicine water initiation and he became a root guru. And she, you know, she would drive him around and help him with things. And yeah, it was a very interesting thing that happened because it transpired that she'd been a student of Tony Rinpoche's in a past life.
Oh,
and she'd have these sort of dreams. He said to her, "You've been my student, da da da." And when we used to talk together, I'd say, "You've got to ask him. Your relationship is so unusual. You know, I can't help here. I can't directly help. You need to ask him." Anyway, she did. And that's what happened. So she found her root guru, like everything, in this one day. Pretty special. Now, we've got a quote that follows. It says, "It is said that making offerings to one poor of the guru who has revealed to us the unmistaken path takes greater merit than honoring and making offerings to the multitude of the Aryas." So the Aryas, of course, are the people who have directly realized emptiness. So the Aryas, the hearers, the self-conquerors, the bodhisattvas, and the Buddhas. So in other words, every spiritual person is highly realized. So what is a poor of the guru? So you think, you know, right, you look at, well, the pores are like I said, the light streams out through the pores of your skin. Right? So it doesn't mean that. Yeah, I know, it's like I thought that. "The merit extends to offerings made to the guru's disciples, family members, and even pets." These are the pores of the guru. The guru's disciples, family members, and even pets. That's right. So even if you did like an upward, so suppose, many of us have taken some initiations by some of these people here. So you said, okay, so Georgia, suppose you and I have taken an initiation with one of these teachers and something that I made an offering to you. This is like an offering to the guru because you and I are in the same lineage now of this guru, right? Is that initiation to be passed down. You know, we're all one thing now. We're all moving in the same direction.
Yeah.
This book and author, Yishi Sondra, who wrote The Essence of Nectar, so sometimes they come in upstairs, they're often in the donation pile. This is a book that it's very small, but Lama Zopa keeps recommending this book as an ideal lam room. It's a practice lam room. There's no commentary, it's just all lam room. It just goes through every topic. It's the meditations. So and he's always saying for us, if you get that book, use that book as your lam room book. Yeah? Otherwise, sometimes he'll give to specific students, you need to read Liberation in your palm of your hand like 3 times or something. So it really depends upon who you are and what the Lama thinks. Right? But in general, I've heard this said a number of times, Lama Zopa and Michelle would always recommend this particular book, The Essence of Nectar, as a Lama meditation text. So we've looked at making material offerings, and we're now going to look at offering respect and service. So here I've got this picture of a massage, and this is because it is the case that sometimes, you know, the teachers aren't well. They have lots of aches and pains and so forth, and sometimes you have a student who can massage. So here you've got to be very careful, because if it's a woman who's good at this and the teacher is a male, you need another person in the room. You can't just do these things. But why? Because sometimes things don't go quite right in those rooms. So they need to have like another person there to see what's, to be safe, basically. It's the same sort of thing if you, like me as a lay person. It's not, the nuns are not meant to like be in a separate room with me by myself. You know, it's just a way of keeping things pure. If there's two nuns in there with me, okay. Now they can check, you know, if there's danger and so forth. So with this sort of thing, we've just got to be sort of careful about it. It's not likely they're going to, well, one person, if it's a monk, they're not likely to accept it.
They're not.
No, they're just going to, they'll politely decline. Yeah, well, no problem then if you go like that and you're not, you know, and you make it quite clear. But even then, it's still, it's tricky.
Yeah.
Because either, you know, you could, the person who's giving out the granny flat could make a false statement, or, you know, and then now what's going to happen?
Yeah.
So it's a little tricky. And it's probably best that you talk to somebody who runs a Dharma center or their assistants, whatever. Most of the traveling teachers have assistants with them, so you're pretty sort of safe, right? Because you can offer them the room and they're fine. So honor the guru through physical acts of respect, like standing when the guru enters and prostrating, help with bathing, cleaning, cooking. When you serve your guru this way, you're doing the real guru yoga. You're not just imagining it in the pujas. So whenever you serve them, do it with like a pure motivation. So again, it's always wise then to think through this offering, may I attain enlightenment? And recognize that the offering and yourself and the guru are empty of any intrinsic nature. And at the same time, so your guru is the manifestations of all the Buddhas. We try to keep that in mind all the time. And you want to try and make, when you do these types of service, to be like happy. And again, Yeshe Sombu says, therefore, I shall strive to reverently serve my gurus with body and speech, by praising and speaking respectfully to them, massaging and bathing them, and offering whatever cherished wealth I have. From offering respect and service, and brief, this is just like a summary of it. Feed them, house them, carry things for them. So often you'll see, like when Ian goes off to bring the lamas from the airport, and then they bring them here. They don't, well, most of them don't bring very, very little. But whatever it is, you know, if we're here, we'll carry the bags and just go, it's fine, you know, walking down there. Here's another simple one. If you're a driver, provide transportation. But here's a thing like massage them. That's why I've got that little asterisk there. You need to sort of abide by the, you know, the rules that the Sangha have to abide by. And the other thing is like, you know, speak well of them. Okay, so it's a little bit finished. So we'll come to our first part of the what's interesting.
Oh,
okay, so now we come to the most important aspect of this. What we end up doing, we had, there's only three things to do. We had to make material offerings first, then there's respect and service. And the last one is the carrying out of the guru's advice. So this is the most important one. This is here, the best way to purify negativities and to accumulate merit. So this is, again, may not be so easy. I think it's probably a heck of a lot easier for us as lay people. We the teachers are quite gentle with the lay community. But I think that once you've committed yourself to this path to take on robes, then it's, now the gloves come off, don't they? It's like now we're both serious here, right? In fact, there's a great story of, you've probably all heard of that great Lama, Atisha, and his main disciple was a lay person called Drom Tongpa. And Lama Atisha had Drom Tongpa and two other people that came with him, was accompanied by Lama Atisha. And, you know, as time went by, they thought, well, let's ask a teacher how well we're doing our practices, how our realizations come any quicker. So one of the people was a meditator, spent most of his time meditating. I think it was a little mixed up here. And it was one of them who was the cook, and I think, and there was drama. And so they asked, and who came out, the person who made the most spiritual progress was the cook. The person who had very little time to do any practice, but he was just serving the guru with guru yoga and just cook making meals. You know, look at who made the most advance in their practice, it was him. Now, when we carry out the advice of the guru, you know, there's a text called 50 Verses on Guru Devotion. That is the text that bridges between the ways of doing it in sutra and then in tantra. So there's lots of material there, lots of different ways of doing this, but it's quite a simple way too, especially for people like ourselves. Right? If we want to follow the guru's advice, then you can do it like this. First of all, stop harming others. That's just, every time you hurt someone else, you hurt yourself. That's just how it works. So what I mean there is, I'm talking about karma here, right? Mm-hmm. So every I had an interesting experience the other day just in relation to this. So I'm sitting there talking to my partner, and she cracked this joke, and I felt absolutely terrible. And so, you know, because I'm trying to practice, right? You know, when you feel terrible, it's not the other person that's causing you to feel terrible. That's the first thing you know. Another person's a condition, yes. If she had not said the joke, I would not have felt terrible. But what's the cause for this terrible feeling I got? So I'm trying to work it out, right? Well, I'm not going to say something nasty back to her and all that sort of stuff. So I'm thinking, okay, so she said this, and I asked her, I said, what? You know, she said, yes, it's a joke. You know, you say this all the time, and blah, blah, blah. I didn't respond to it as if it were a joke. So I'm saying, so what is the cause of my suffering? What do you think? So I'm guessing, because we don't actually know, do we? Because that's it. But as a guess, what do you think it might be?
Your own mind?
Yeah, but in what aspect? It's karma. Right?
Self-cherishing? Yeah.
Yeah, sure, that's all that. Specifically.
Harsh speech.
Oh. I have spoken harshly to others and hurt others before with my speech. Right? Now I hear the same, and it stopped. Right? I finished speaking, now I've got a cause on my mind stream. She says this thing to me, I hear it as an attack on me. This harsh speech. She used to say, that's a joke. It's a joke. Yeah, that's not how I heard it. Right? So why do I hear it like that? And others would go, no problem to us, Eddie. It's a joke, mate.
Yeah.
Right? And so that is a sin. That's what I'm going, right. Got to keep an eye on my speech. Because I know I speak quite harshly. I'm very lazy with my speech. Sometimes it's harsh speech, but often it's just swearing. Yeah, it's not proper, not gentle speech. But she spoke gentle speech as a joke, right? But I heard it as a rough speech, as a means of hurting me.
People do say some pretty terrible things, yes, and then dismiss it as being a joke. It's when they're being manipulative or gaslighting.
And that's how I heard it, right? So, I would, there's something not right in this, just in the tone and the things I. That was the thing that I let, hang on, and it made me quite sing, right? Now, whether it was actually that way or not, you know, you don't know.
Because somebody else would have heard it differently, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you can't, No, because I didn't hear it as harsh. Right, it didn't come, well, I'm saying to, it's not, it wasn't harsh speech though.
No, but it was.
Why did
she
explain it as a joke if there wasn't some issue?
Again, you guys are missing the point, I think. Whatever it is, that's all conditions. They're conditions. If we attack the condition, the cause remains. No, I came pretty much straight away. All I knew was you cannot respond harshly back here because her speech is not the cause. I'm saying, no, I didn't. No, but that's. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Now I'm saying, you remove the conditions, but the cause remains, so it can happen again to you and again to you, which it does. Yeah. So, helping the awareness, so what does it help? What does it help you do?
You can take this, you can put it in its place and know what's going on.
The thing here is again, it's just like avoid harming others, right?
Yeah.
So, it's a condition. I am harmed. Why? Because I have the cause. Causes meet conditions. Effects take place. I can know that this is a really uncomfortable feeling I'm having. I call it suffering. Now, if you don't have a background in this sort of way of thinking, the normal response is attack the other person.
Yeah.
Right? So now they're hurt, and you're hurt too. And it's that old story, isn't it? The whole world full of hurt. We're not, you know, so at least I could not kick the whole thing off again. You know, there is that sort of thing where you're sort of sitting there in a way like, in a way I was sort of pleased that I didn't attack back and I could work it out and go, yeah, here's the condition. The other thing to remember here, right, is as we are unenlightened people, we are under the control of karma and affliction. That's just running this thing that we call me, the person. So it's already a walking wound. You know, so any stuff like that, it's like, you know, you hear something nice or something. So our suffering diminishes. It's not that we get happy, but we call it happy. Because our suffering is diminished, right? You go, oh, that's really nice. But when you get bumped into a word or a few words, then it increases. And it's what it showed me straight away. It's like, you know, I did not decide to get upset about this. But that tells me I don't have control over my mind, which is exactly what the first noble truth is telling us, right? You lack control. And here I have an example to show me how out of control I am. And it just says, also, gosh, you know, you look at it, you go, oh my God, in terms of renunciation, you're sort of thinking, I've got to give that up. I don't want that to keep happening to me. You know, so it's sort of a way to like inspire us to, this sort of thing is like a wake up, you know, where you sort of want to, well, this is why renunciation is required. You know, I could not stop my mind from like producing the feeling that I was under attack just by hearing those words. It wasn't up to me. Anyway, just, you know, as an example, as a story, these sort of things might happen. Is again, so whenever you get that sting, first thing is like, don't attack the object that you think is providing the harm. That's a condition. It's met the cause. You know, like I said, you know, self-grasping, self-cherishing, harmful speech in a past life, all these sort of things you can try and knock it down to. And then help them. So, you know, this girl sitting here asking, what's going on? Talk to me, talk to me. And I'm nearly frozen, right? Going, Jesus, how do I explain this? What to say? Don't want to add any more harm. You know, you're trying to be gentle and explain it and go, that's really about me. It's, you know, but she's going, I won't say these things again. I won't joke. And you go, no, that's not going to work. Very nice, but no, that's not the method. You know? That's like the method of saying, you know, I need to cover the earth with leather. No, I said, no, just put some shoes on your feet.
But by explaining to her that in a when you, I feel type of context, you're at least giving her the opportunity to not inflict further hurt.
Of course. Yeah. So, and, you know, people want to know what's, they care about one another, right? You want to know what's going on with one another.
Mm.
And, like I said, if possible, help others. Now, as holiness always whips us around the other way, right? He goes, like, this is a Mahayana. He goes, first of all, try and help people as much as you can. But if you can't, do not hurt them.
Yeah.
The other way, the vehicle of the hearers, you know, the non-Mahayana would go, no harm first, then help. Mahayana goes, help first, if you can't help, don't do harm. So you can sort of see the... Yeah.
Isn't that the medical thing?
Yes, it is.
At least do no harm.
Yeah. Again, I've taken this, you know, what the essence of the Buddha Dharma is. Now, when I asked Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, what is your Dharma? And this is what he said. Don't hurt others. What's it? Maybe it was that, I think, or maybe one of the students was asked to explain the Buddha's teachings. What's he teaching? So one example of that was when he's Omnia Dharma Hetu Prabhama Hetu Dharagara Yavada Deshin Chaya Niroda Yavadi Mahashwamadi Asoha. He says that, right? He says, this is the Buddha's teachings. He goes, what do you mean? What's that mean? Well, all conditions depend upon, so... all effects depend upon their causes. The teacher has explained those causes. And then same for the cessation. This too has been explained. But probably when they said that, the guy understood immediately and not wasn't enlightened, but became an arahat pretty much straight away because he understood. But this one is also said, if you will accept the Buddha's teachings, do no harm, help others, subdue your mind. That's it. Then it's really nice, isn't it? If you think about it, that's all we have to do, right?
What do you mean by subdue, as in?
Don't let your mind, like for this one here, it was, for me, it was subdue the mind of anger from erupting towards my partner. You know, it's like, don't get angry now just because you feel like she said something terrible to you and that life's not worth living anymore. Mm-hmm. yeah, like subdue the, you know, this aggressive response. Subdue your harmful words. And last, of course, is this altruistic attitude. In fact, there's a number of books we've got here about the Kadampa tradition. And there's tremendous advice on that when you read on that, because what the books are made up of is these questions and answers. And the questions are always by the students of great masters. And sometimes you look at them and you go, wow, the student is a great master, and he's asking his teacher, like they would say, what is the Dharma? And you get this amazing, really short, concise, pithy answer. There's no, what I like, there's no escape. Right? It's just straight at you. Really easy to understand. And it's just, okay, that's what Dharma is, and then you should want more Dharma. But his Kadampa books are very, like a useful, very pithy little sayings. And they always come back to this altruistic attitude. Is there anything you'd like to say before you end this meditation in terms of carrying out the guru's advice?
Yes.
Yeah, so when the lamas give advice, there's general advice. So like, you know, someone's in the room, lama, Pacific lamas come here, teach from here. A lot of people in the room and there's advice given about what we should do. So that's one type of advice. And I'd suggest that if it's, you know, you can adopt that, take that up if you wish to. Then there's personal advice. So like you might hear the general advice and try it out and then go, gee, this doesn't really suit me. So then he might wish to go, okay, so I'd like to have an appointment with the teacher, please. And you say, now, on this day, you gave me this type of advice, and this is what's happened in the advice. So I remember one of our students, we were given the Yamataka initiation. No, sorry, we weren't. We were doing a teaching on death and rebirth. And so I guess I led us through the different stages of death and dying, right, and the visualizations that followed. So she took these up as a meditation, right, and became really depressed. And like I wanted to sort of stop, basically. And bless her heart, she went and saw Geshe-la and asked him about it. So what he said? He said, stop. Stop. Because getting depressed and going down, this is not a result you want, right? So he said, stop. And then he said, I'll be giving the Yamataka initiation in about a month or so. I'll take that up and then apply it within that meditation. Don't do it just on its own. So if you ever, like I said again, if you ever get anything funny happen, but you know, you try it and advice, you'll try it. And like it doesn't sit well with you, then stop. And please don't like share your dislike of it with other people. And yeah, it's up to you. You can either just stop and leave it alone, or go and see them. So this works with like general advice and also like personal advice. Because like her, this was just for personal advice, right? Whereas other people are not having a problem with this type of meditation, they don't need to wait for the other type of meditation to come. Okay, so let's do our first meditation. So just get comfortable in your seats. Here we'll just check that the back is straight and shoulders are relaxed. The head is sitting evenly on the neck. The hands and feet are comfortable. And your body is breathing itself. So the mind, stable and quiet, bring your teacher to mind. And feel the gift of having a living guide for this path. Then set an altruistic motivation. Now, of all the ways to honor your teacher, which is the most powerful? The most powerful way to honor your teacher is to carry out the teacher's advice with your body, speech, and mind. If you carry out the guru's advice with your body, speech, and mind, applying full devotion to this, what does that mean? What does it mean to take to engage with your body, speech, and mind with full devotion? Just carry out the teacher's advice by seeing them as the embodiment of all the enlightened beings. The very Buddha himself. This makes the offering more powerful than any material gift. It's the greatest way you can make an offering. So without that sort of follow through, and even the richest offering leaves the deepest work undone. Now imagine a student doctor working beside a master surgeon. A student doctor that could study alone for years, but working at the master surgeon's side, following each step with great care, builds real skill fast. By carrying out the guru's advice works the same way. It's learning through devoted participation. So if we ask ourselves, what made Rob Tongpa surpass the monk who only did retreat? The devoted service purifies karma so deeply that realizations arise on their own. Milarepa was unable to make any material gifts, yet reached enlightenment just in one lifetime. What might be the true meaning of offering? The true meaning of offering is transformation. So can sweeping and cooking or serving your Dharma community become a real practice? Now, yes, it can. Thinking that you're actually serving the Buddha himself as these acts purify your karma brings you closer to enlightenment. And every act of service becomes living guru yoga. So perhaps just for the rest of the week, just look back over your life and find one piece of your guru's advice that you've not yet acted on. And try for one day, treat it as your main practice. As Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, pleasing the guru by fulfilling his wishes is itself the quick path to enlightenment. Breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. Okay, so now we've got to this, so we're looking here at carrying out the guru's advice. Now, when the guru offers advice or gives us advice, here's the question that's asked. Is absolute obedience required? Now, well, the answer is no, but it's quite easy to feel as if it is. And many other people have felt this way in the past, and they acted on that feeling and got themselves into trouble. Yeah, that's right. Well, that's right. Yeah, okay, you'll be okay with the sin.
Yeah,
that's right. Now, sometimes advice is given, but the person who's given the advice, like the traveling teacher, doesn't know about the laws of the country. And we've also had the case that the controlling center of all the FPMT, you know, so we're part of it, right? And they're based in America. So they've asked us to do things, and if they're against Australian law.
Oh.
Right? They didn't know. They don't know, right? They think it's the same as American law, so they ask us to do it like this. And straight away, you can see all the problems and go like no, right? So this is one of the first questions you can ask yourself. Is it against the law of the land? And if it is, don't do it. And you just explain to the teacher, right? why we can't do this. Is it contrary to the Dharma or your vows? This is the other thing, like Chris was saying, right? So, some of you might have remembered that story where there's a really bright student in the class of bright students. So, the teacher to check on them suggests that, yeah, the really good student will do anything for his teacher. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've got all these great stories. Everyone agrees, it's like, I want you to go out and steal these things for me. And so it was, okay, off they go. Except for one of them. You know, he goes, no, like, it's against the law of the country, it's against the law of Dharma, and it's also against your vow. So, you know, you can say, sorry, I can't do that. Okay, well, good. You know, you're a very, very good student. Yeah, so another good question we can ask ourselves. But this other one is this one here. What is the difference just a small negativity?
Is
what
there
is
such
it?
Thing?
No, yeah. Yeah, so one of the, so anyway, this is, we've got to think of this. So although karma continues to expand, we really could always, karma could come to an end too. Now, all the causes of suffering can be overcome. Now, this doesn't mean to say that no suffering takes place. You do something wrong, it's saying, are you prepared to take the suffering that comes along with this? If you say, yes, I am, away you go.
Any example of, like, is this what a teacher
might ask? Oh, well, no, I don't.
It's that
one
story. You said that you were driving
General
Ravina around that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Something against the traffic.
Oh, no, that was not General Ravina.
If I've been in General Ravina's cast like that too, just do it. You're going to go like, oh, no.
I've done that.
Yeah.
It was going, there was a river was flooding and there were all the signs, do not cross the river. And said, go for it. And I was like, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
And it's all right.
Yeah,
well, it worked out okay.
It worked out okay. Yeah. We should have done.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just that sort of thing, is because if the car swept away or something like that, it's like, well, you're both at fault, aren't you?
Yeah.
You could say, right? One instructor.
I think that's the biggest karma there. You, because you followed.
I mean, not because
they're
venerable,
it's just more. Yeah. That's the same I thought with I've thought of this too, thinking up there's a lot of starving people, and you knew there was a lot of food in this warehouse. And you could go, okay, no, yeah, I know stealing is against the law and so forth, but you could go and break in there and feed the others, right? Still a negativity.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, okay, you do this. You have to bear the karmic consequence of doing this negativity. Like Chris was saying here, this one, you know, saying the Buddha recognizes and knows. So this is a story now. The Buddha was not the Buddha at this time. He was a bodhisattva, highly realized bodhisattva. He was able to know the mental dispositions of the people on this boat. And he realized that, you know, one of these people was going to sink the whole ship and rob all the corpses. And, you know, from our perspective, we could say, oh, there could have been all these things you could have done to stop it. And yes, there may have been, but in this case, he took the thing of killing the person. That's the outcome. So now, does this mean nothing happens to them? Yeah, no, not at all. So he's doing out this great bodhicitta, right? With a wish to save all these lives and to stop this person accruing the karma of the deaths of all these people on the boat, right? So that benefits the person he's about to kill, if that shortens his life. It benefits all the other people on the boat. Who does it not benefit?
Yeah.
That's right. And he goes, and I'm willing to do that. And so he does. And when he becomes the Buddha, what happens to him? Yeah, so what happens is when somebody else tries to kill him, right, a little splinter of the rock comes off and bounces across it and cuts into his toe. Yeah? And then this one, the student says, what's the cause of that? And he goes, in a past life, I did these things. And this is the effect of this life.
Small consequence.
Yeah, very, very small, because of his great, you know, realizations and the purification and all these sort of things. And it doesn't upset his mind. It's a physical thing.
When I hear that story, I always think of a drag omniscience, is in a sense. But it's like, I mean, you put it in, you know that someone's going to kill someone, and you know you can do something about it. And it's like, it's an impossible situation. Like, I've got to kill the guy. It seems like having that knowledge about being a Buddha, and actually like being a Bodhisattva as a person of Buddha, it's like it could be a burden in a way, like that, having that, being able to read people's minds and stuff and know all this stuff.
It would be if you thought it was all true. Right. You thought it was all truly existed, but it doesn't. So it's no burden. Now, but so how to respond though? This is this next bit. So next week. Yeah. So I put these questions and answers up, and today I've got even better responses. I'll put a few of these back again, you know, just to have a look at it. Oh, that didn't come up last time. That's sort of interesting. So we're talking about how to respond, right? So just like I try to respond with my partner, why not abusing her because she made me feel like this, right? It's the same thing here. Right? If the teacher's asking you to do things that you feel quite uncomfortable about, you're quite within your rights to say no. But then the question is, like, how do you say no? Is that because I know, like, it's very easy to say no when you're angry, right? And you've got the tone, isn't it? It comes out and you are actually angry. Yeah, you're fiery, right? You're not calm. You don't hear those things. Right? So what we want to be able to say is no, but still have respect for the person, still like them. So for me, that's quite hard. You know, I sort of say no, it means you're all off. It's like everything about you is wrong. No. But of course, no one exists like that. Yeah, that's not that all or nothing, black and white thinking. But no one exists like that. So how to respond? He says, following a spiritual teacher's advice when it aligns with virtuous dharma-based action, but refrain when it conflicts with ethical teachings. He says, when choosing not to follow certain instructions, maintain respect and avoid negativity towards your spiritual teacher. Communicate your reasons openly and respectfully, preserving the integrity of your relationship. If an instruction which is contrary to your vows or the teaching is given, so the teacher is going to give you some advice, right, which is the teaching, part of the teaching. Right? You have to refer to what your knowledge of the teaching is and go, does that contradict what I've heard before? If it does, it doesn't sit right with me. I don't understand. I need to ask you about that. You know, and it might be that the teacher says, yes, within that context, you're quite right, but the context has changed. So now it's different. That's real possible. So, yeah, like I said, when I get upset with the person, not what they said. I mean, what they said upsets me too, but I'm always looking at the person, thinking, you know, they're attacking me. Same sort of thing as I have with my partner, right? They said the words, I go, you, blah, 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 right? But it's not them, is it? It's the words, and the words were just a condition to strike something off in me. So for us, don't look at your teacher as an idiot or some sort of, you know, negative connotation that you bring forward. Don't try not to do that. Just look at what they said and go, does this conform with the teachings? Does it work with my vows? You know, you can just say, that's advice I can't follow. So it says here, if an instruction contrary to your vows or teaching is given, first of all, restrain yourself from despising or disrespecting the teacher. Like I said, this is very hard for me. I find it personally difficult. I hear or somebody says something to me or doesn't, then I look at you. And it's like, you're an idiot. What you just said wasn't very bright. Okay. So we don't want to do that with our teachers. Yeah. Then refrain from slandering or belittling the teachers. Of course I did, but I said, you're an idiot. So I'll belittle them. Do not develop a bad attitude towards your teacher, and do not fundamentally damage the special relationship between them. Because it is a special relationship, isn't it? You have decided this is the person I'm going to rely upon to lead me out of samsara. And so once you've made that decision, it's like deciding to marry somebody, getting to the aisle and going, change my mind. I don't think you're going to have a very good relationship after that. So it's the same sort of thing here. You know, don't damage this relationship. Like I said, it's a special relationship. You're seeing them as an enlightened being. This is, you know, you don't see your husband like that or other people like that normally. So when we say no, we're saying no to the what we perceive as unskillful advice or advice that we can't do. Then we have to explain to them why we cannot carry out their advice. So again, this is, you know, remember we're developing a relationship with the teacher. And the teacher, the relationship, the teacher has been seen by you and you're behaving towards the teacher as if they were an enlightened being. I was just sort of thinking here about what my partner was saying to me. She was trying to keep on like, talk to me, explain to me what's happening to you. It's a similar type thing here that when you go like to explain, you know, if I was your teacher and you know one of you was my personal student, you're looking like, of course I want to help you. But how can I if you don't talk to me? You know, you might think, well, you're a Buddha, aren't you? You should know. And you go, you didn't know. But remember again, the person doesn't actually have to be an enlightened being. The thing is, you need to see them that way, but they don't have to be that. So if you look at that, think, well, okay, then they're going to have to know a bit more about why I can't do this thing. But, so in any relationship, aren't they often improved by good dialogue? Where you actually understand each other, and how do you get to understand each other? Through talking and listening, this is handy. But same here. If you want a teacher to sort of get some understanding about you, you need to share something about yourself. And of course, these things do not have to be personal, but they often are, because we often relate to our teachers as if they're therapists, but in fact, they're not. And in fact, in Bersin's book, he gives this warning, you know, about how we often see the teacher and how he relates to them. And the Tibetans don't do that at all. In fact, Bersin said he never knew a thing about his personal teachers, his teacher's personal life. In all the years he served him, he never spoke about himself in that way. He's like, no, I'm here to help you. And we try to help each other on the mental level, aren't we? Yeah, so you do need to learn to communicate better than what we want to do and share our fears. Again, this is not so easy, especially for men, I think. I think men don't like to be seen about that we're weak in something, like we can't do things. You know, but then again, you look at it, well, that's affective pride, isn't it? We've actually got problems there. We need to talk to one another. And again, without irritation or anger. Ah, yes, in fact, there is. No, but there's bargaining too. So, in fact, one of the, who's our guest up the top here, the recent, most recent one? Yes, you should. Remember that? When he tried to bargain with his teacher? Yeah, so he was given instruction to, he was to write, recite the Vajrakata Sutra so many times. So he said, oh, can I get that? I get 100 sankha then he's to recite, I'll get 100 times that at once. And as long as I love it, not this time. This time you have to do it. Yeah, so there's that. I was trying to think of this thing where it's like this bargaining idea, you know, where you say, oh, here we go. Yeah, so you can go to your teacher. Simple one. Huh? You may have you're older, so your knees are a bit locked up and things like that. And so you want to do 100,000 prostrations. So you go to the teacher and say, you know, like, my knees are locked up. I cannot do the 100,000 prostrations. She goes, oh, could you? She says, oh, okay. Could you just do the short prostration? You go, not very well, no. And you might shove it, it really hurts. Yeah, okay. Then maybe say, okay, so like your body does it. Well, I can't do this. Okay. Well, I can't do this. That's okay. How about you just put your hands together like this and just recite that prostration to the Buddhas 100,000 times? Yeah. Because although there is benefit of doing the actual long physical prostration, the major thing that you want from frustration is a change of mind, is to develop humility, not to have this, you know, a great flexible body, because you can do 100,000 things. It's humility, which is a mental quality. So if you could develop that by just putting your hands together and being in front of an image of the deity or something, or bringing one inside, you go, yeah, okay, do it that way. So there are many, many skillful ways of bargaining. I'm not privy to them all, Ben. But I bet you those people like these people, they know about a lot of them.
I was just thinking about it a bit taller than you know.
But you know that story? There's a woman went up to CI. She was between 70 and 80 years old, and when she started off, she was doing them, they had like mattresses.
Yeah.
Right? She had to go down, but over time, like, the mattresses become less and less. Oh. I mean, she was down on the floor.
But there's no escape.
Yeah. There's another girl there, I remember, like, you know, just vomiting, just like rushing out the door, and then come back in and do it again. Keep going on this car. Oh my God, I don't think I've got the mental capacity to do it like that. I do that, I'm out of that. Yeah. There's a quote here from Lama Tsongkhapa. He says, when we respond, you know, discuss the situation in an open and a reasonable manner, politely explain why you are able to comply with the instruction, then excuse yourself with soothing words. So, like I said, these. The lamas are like, you know, like I said, lamas like a mother, right? A person who's given birth to this great mind. Then this is not like going and talking to your father about trying to get something, right? But most of the time they're really gentle and accommodating. They know how hard it is for us to do this sort of thing. You know, so they're very open to what you have to say. They're also very on point, you know. Like, yeah. But they are trying to help us. There's no malice there. You know? And if you think there are, you just, again, excuse yourself. I think probably the best thing to do is say that you can't understand each other. And if it's a language barrier, then try and get another monk or nun who speaks, who understands your language and understands the language of the teacher, and, you know, work with another person. Anything else you'd like to ask about this? Okay, let's do our last presentation. Again, just the posture, your spine is straight, your shoulders relaxed. Your head is sitting evenly on your neck, and you're breathing normally and naturally. Again, just bring your teacher to mind. Be grateful that you have a guide for the path. And you set an altruistic motivation to understand guru devotion. So what does real devotion to a teacher look like in daily life? So in other words, you know, what does your devotion to a teacher look like in daily life? The key point is this. However you devote yourself to the teacher, this devotion requires wise discernment, not blind obedience. Please think about how you're relating to the teacher. Learn how to do so and do it that way. In other words, follow advice, it's the Dharma. If advice is given that clearly breaks your vows, then decline with calm respect. Because then without discernment, blind compliance will quietly erode the very vows your guru wants you to keep. So, you know, most of you have vehicles or cars, and sometimes you've got a GPS in there, and it gives you instructions. But if the instruction from the GPS told you to drive off a bridge, you stop, wouldn't you? You check the GPS. You do the same with the teachings, the instructions of your teacher. You don't throw the GPS away, you just don't follow the advice. So how do you check if advice fits the Dharma? Well, you hold it against the Buddha's core teachings, to restrain from harm, to help, to watch the mind. If the instructions align with the Dharma, then follow the instructions if you can. If it breaks vows, just ask yourself to be excused. Now, can you picture yourself saying a respectful no to your teacher? If you can, what else arises? Through fear or pride or care for the vows? Silent compliance with the wrong advice from your teacher harm your teacher more than speaking up? All right, from today onwards, if advice feels wrong, use calm and warm words. State your reason, then ask to be excused. Because keeping your vows is the most profound offering you can make. As the Dalai Lama says, refer to the teachings rather than to the person. You respond in that spirit, your devotion will stay wise and whole. Now breathing in through the nostrils, exhale, let your eyes open. So we've now come to the end of the class. You know, so do you remember what those three devotional acts are? Making offerings, making physical offerings, very simple.
Providing service.
Providing services, respect, and lastly, following the advice, that's right. And following the advice is the most important. And there are respectful ways to respond when difficulties arise. So try to remain as calm as you are. Relate to the advice given, not the person. And try not to be angry like me. Try not to be, what do you call that when you're
reactive
and you put people down like you idiot. So don't try not to do that like I sometimes do. Okay. Well, next week, so up online, of course, there's some material up there. Have a look at Berzin's articles. There's some notes by the FPMT, pages 15 to 26. And this little part is the guru devotion in action. That's what we've been sort of talking. So try to memorize this idea. Okay, I could make physical offerings. I can relate to them with respect and service. And the best thing I can do is follow the advice, is actually engage in the teachings and do it. We'll talk, look at this, respecting the different lineages, and deciding if nothing works at all, what to do then. So that's what we'll look at next week. So until then, let's dedicate the merit that we've accrued. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of the Buddha and lead all living beings, without exception, into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel of Bodhicitta and my take born and rise from the grave. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. In the prayer for His Holiness's long life, the wish granted, the wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, truly and incomparably kind, taking guts of our visage. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And then the prayer for Rinpoche's fifth return. In whole of the spirit of these precious and complete teachings with exploration and practice, you wore the armor of patience as ever at this moment. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, and let this like, I'm sorry, I just keep looking at this. You wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. I think I was very discouraged when I got there. Yeah, thank you, Bill.
Thank you.